Good afternoon, members. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. Representative Ward moves approval of the March 7th minutes. Any discussions, changes, additions, or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, the first item on our agenda today is going to be testimony on the charter school lease aid from the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Welcome to the committee. Sir, please state your name for the record so that 100 years from now we know who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eugene Piccolo. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Mr. Chair and members, first I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about the charter school lease aid program, the impact of the governor's proposed elimination of what is known as the grandfather clause or allowance, and what impact that would have on schools. And finally, to share a couple ideas we have with regard to lease aid policy. First, the charter school lease aid program was enacted by the legislature in 1998 to provide funding for the facility lease costs of charter schools, which by law cannot own buildings directly. They cannot purchase or own buildings directly using public funds, even though they're public schools. And second, they do not have the power to levy taxes for facilities like traditional school districts. You may ask why the legislature, when it enacted the nation's first charter school law, prohibited charter schools from using public funds to directly own or purchase a school facility. The answer seems to be twofold when one talks to former legislators and others involved in the passage of the legislation. At the time, charter schools were a new idea, and the state did not want to be saddled with the debts on buildings or with the buildings themselves if the idea of charter schools did not pan out. The second reason seems to be that charter schools were designed to focus on expanding learning opportunities for kids, improving academic achievement, and creating new, innovative, and different teaching methods, assessments, outcome measures, professional opportunities for educators, including the opportunity to govern and manage schools. Whatever the reason and the intent of the law, the issue of finding appropriate facilities for charter schools and paying for those facilities has been and continues to be a significant challenge for charter schools, not just in Minnesota, but across the country. As I noted a minute ago, in 1998, the legislature enacted the lease aid program to assist for paying for the lease cost of school facilities for charter schools. The lease aid rate in 1998 was established at $1,500 per pupil unit and stayed at that rate until 2003, the year of the last fiscal crisis of the state. In response to that fiscal crisis, charter school lease aid was cut by 20%, or $300, to a maximum of $1,200 per pupil unit. There was also provision that the aid would be limited to 90% of the lease cost, up to the maximum of $1,200 per pupil amount. So, for example, if the actual per pupil lease cost for a school is $952, the school gets 90% of that amount, or $857, for lease aid. If the actual per pupil cost is $1,200, the school gets 90% of that amount, or $1,080. If the actual per pupil cost for the lease is $1,650, the school gets a maximum of $1,200. So no matter what the school's lease aid is, the maximum is $1,200. It is important to note that the actual lease cost for charter schools in this fiscal year is $53,423,634. Lease aid covers $44 million of that $53 million, or 83% of actual costs. So lease aid does not cover the full cost of leases. Just over $9 million of that, or 17% of the actual lease costs, are being paid out of the general funds accounts of charter schools. So it's coming from money that would be spent in the classroom. When the legislature cut aid in 2003, it also established a grandfather clause or allowance for schools whose leases were above the $1,200 maximum set under the new rate. Today, there are 29 schools that are covered by the grandfather clause. 10 of those schools no longer have leases exceeding $1,200 per pupil unit, so they are in fact not getting any funding under the grandfather provision. All of them fall under the 90% provision of the 2003 rate. You may ask why those 10 schools have a lower per pupil unit cost today than they did in 2003. And there are two simple answers. One is the growth in school enrollment, which lowers the per pupil cost, and some of those schools have grown significantly in the last 8 years. And second is schools have moved to different facilities than they were located in 2003, which again changed the lease costs. So this leaves 19 charter schools receiving funds under the grandfather clause or allowance. The total grandfather cost of the grandfather clause for those 19 schools is $1,008,000 this past year. There are three things to note about these 19 schools. First, the grandfather clause was set at a specific dollar amount for each individual school above the new $1,200 maximum. So if a school was getting $1,300 per student under the old formula, that's where they were grandfathered in. If a school was getting $1,500, they were grandfathered in $1,500. So the grandfather rates range from $1,226 per pupil unit to one school that gets $1,603 per pupil unit. All the other schools fall in that middle range. Also, of all those 19 schools, all of them have actual lease costs of at least $1,350 per pupil unit. Nine of those 19 schools have affiliated building companies, which means they are locked into long-term leases at rates set, and a couple others have long-term leases because government agencies provided funding for the facility.
Mr. Piccolo, what was the number on the affiliated building companies?
There are nine of the 19 that have affiliated building companies.
Is there any way we could get the listing of those nine companies?
Yes, we can get you.
Unless you have them off the top of your head, you can tell us, but if we could, you don't need to tell us, that's okay.
I actually can tell you.
Oh, sure, go ahead, let's hear it then.
Metro Def, School El Caleo, Hope Academy, Excel, Ag and Food Sciences, St. Paul City School, Bluffview, Montessori, Community of Peace, Higher Ground, and Math and Science Academy.
And if we could...
And I can send you that list.
That'd be fantastic. Thank you. Please proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, so nine of those 19 schools have affiliated companies, and a couple others have, as I said, long-term leases because of the way those facilities were funded. Some through U.S. agricultural funding money because they're located in rural parts of the state. And affiliated building companies were recognized by this legislature in 2009 as a legitimate way of providing for facilities for charter schools. An affiliated building company is a nonprofit company created by the charter school to either purchase or construct a facility for the school. Until 2009, there were no regulations or rules for creating affiliated building companies, and the law was changed to put some requirements in. The school has to be in existence at least 5 years to create a company. The school has to have a long-range plan and so forth. There's a number of criteria that were put in the law. The third thing I want to mention is that the lease aid amounts for the schools currently receiving funding under the grandfather clause range in actual dollars. For New Country School, for example, is their total amount under the grandfather clause is $2,500, but for Community Peace School, it's $170,000, and they enroll over 840 kids. So the actual amount is actually tied, again, to their lease as well as their grandfather clause. With this as an overview and background, Mr. Chair, I would like to ask Karen Rustoven, the director of Community Peace School in St. Paul, and Diane Sherwood, director of Metro Deaf School, to share what the elimination of the grandfather allowance would have on their specific schools. And there are also other people here who could answer specific questions about individual schools.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, Karen Rusthoven, and I'm the executive director at Community of Peace Academy. Community of Peace is a bond school with a long-term lease that cannot be changed. This lease was based on the state funding of $1,500 per pupil unit, and if it were reduced to $1,200, it would cost the school, we believe, approximately $200,000 a year, and that is an enormous mountain that we probably would not be able to climb, given the nature of a charter school. I'm going to say that when I founded the school in 1995, we were located in an old Catholic school building, 1938 and 1951 construction. And quite frankly, I thought we were going to just stay there, and that was going to be it. But I attended the National Charter School Conference in Denver about a year or two later, and attended some facility sessions and realized that charter schools all across the country were building real school buildings for their kids. And it really gave me a new vision that these were public school children. And why shouldn't they have a school like all other public school children? It was inspirational to me, and I want to say that I have been very proud of the state of Minnesota for their lease aid law and for the fact that it is possible in the state of Minnesota for our kids to have the same kind of facilities that all public school kids deserve. I believe that our school has budgeted very conservatively from the beginning, in spite of the fact that charter schools can only be renewed for 3 years at a time in the state of Minnesota. We were able to get rated bonds from Standard & Poor's, which is, you know, quite a compliment and an achievement, and helped considerably on financing our bonds. We hope and trust that we will be able to count on the state of Minnesota to support our school through the payments on this bond arrangement. We will be most grateful to you for your consideration. We serve approximately 730 students. We have capacity for more than that, but it's a pre-K-12 on the east side. Our population is almost entirely free and reduced lunch, and we have about 70% of our kids who are learning English as their second language. And the facilities that the state of Minnesota has provided them are very, very nice and very well support their education, so thank you.
Thank you. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Sherwood, and I am the director at Metro Deaf School. We are located in St. Paul, Minnesota. My school was established in 1993, so we were one of the first charter schools to open in Minnesota. And at that time, there was no lease aid, and we were scrambling to figure out how to cover the costs of running a charter school. When lease aid came to be in 1998, yes, we were granted $1,500 per student. We serve deaf and hard of hearing students throughout the metro area in western Wisconsin, so our population remains, as a low incidence handicap group, fairly small. At this time, we serve preschool through 12th grade and a Transition Plus program to age 21, and we have about 107 students currently from 44 school districts. The lease aid reduction for us would impact us greatly just because we're 100% special ed, so all of our money comes in and goes out. Our special education aid cannot be used towards our lease. We do have a building company, which we established in 2006 to purchase, which purchased and renovated a site for us, and then also added a high school component on 2 years ago. That bonding, those loans come due in 2028 and 2029. So right now, what our lease costs are to our building company, what we pay to our building company, is pretty locked and final. The reduction to $1,200 per student for us would mean approximately 20% reduction of lease aid, or 11% of our total general ed revenue and lease aid if you add it all up. That is about $35,000, which doesn't seem like a lot of money, but in a small program, $35,000 would staff a teacher or a couple of paraprofessionals for some of our students with more severe handicaps, and cover some of our non-reimbursables, which are not covered by the state. Again, we are very grateful to everything Minnesota has done for charter schools, and we have a beautiful facility as well, which meets the needs of our students who come to us from all over the Twin Cities. And as Karen stated, we really hope that the committee will consider our plea to not reduce lease aid. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, just want to outline our position on this issue of elimination of the grandfather clause and briefly share a proposal we have forthcoming in legislation. First, let me be clear that we oppose the governor's proposal to eliminate the grandfather clause in the charter school lease aid program. But we also recognize that if the school is not utilizing the grandfather clause because they've been able to reduce their lease costs, that it would be appropriate that the school no longer continue to be eligible for the grandfather amount going forward. Second, we urge that the legislature maintain the grandfather clause for the schools that are still receiving the funding under this clause. We suggest that the schools maintain eligibility and funding until the school's current lease expires if they're leasing in the open market, and there are about six of those that are just leasing from regular businesses or landlords, and that rate continue until those leases expire. And for those who have affiliated building companies like Community Peace and Metro Def, that the grandfather amount be maintained until the current mortgage or bonds are paid off, or until the affiliated building company renegotiates the mortgage or bonds at a lower rate than they're currently paying. Finally, we support the creation of a lease aid incentive that would allow a charter school who negotiates a lease at a lower rate than the cost under the 90% or 1200 maximum to keep half of the savings for the classroom, and half would be savings to the state. This would provide some leverage and incentive for schools in negotiating with landlords, because right now landlords all know how much a school can get under the program, and if you look at the chart that the department has issued, you see most schools have their lease aid at least the maximum amount. Second, this would provide a way of putting more money in the classroom without any additional expenditures by the state. And third, it would save the state money. It's one of those rare things where the school, the students, and the state all win at the same time. Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Members of the committee, do we have any questions for our testifiers? Mr. Piccolo, who's carrying your bill that you suggested for your changes?
Pardon me?
Who's carrying your bill?
Representative Woodard, if Mr. Chair, is carrying that bill. And Representative Slocum is also a co-author on the bill, and there's some others.
So there is peace in the valley.
There's peace in the valley.
Any questions for members of the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. We really appreciate it, and appreciate especially the two people who don't work here coming down to share your thoughts with us. Thank you very much, and thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you.
And we thank you, Mr. Chair, and members.
Okay, well then. Next, members, the chair will move House File 873 for passage and referral to the Tax Committee. Maybe Representative Greiling could tell us what this bill is, but I'm moving House File 873 for passage and referring to the Tax Committee, and Representative Greiling, you could tell us what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I compliment you on getting a vehicle bill out of Mr. Crow that doesn't cause all sorts of unnecessary questions that you didn't expect on a mere little old vehicle bill. It didn't quite do me that favor, obviously.
Any discussion on House File 873? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The House File 873 is passed and sent to the Tax Committee. The Chair will also move House File 874 for passage, recommend for passage and referral to the Tax Committee. Representative Growling, you have any comments on this one either?
Mr. Chair, ditto.
Thank you. Any discussion from members of the committee? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The motion is adopted, and House File 874 is referred to the Tax Committee. Members, the next bill on our agenda is going to be, I believe that Representative Downey is busy in another committee right now, so we're going to take up House File 511. This is the Erickson bill. And Representative Erickson, what is your motion today? Where would you like this bill to go?
Mr. Chair, I would move that 511 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
So moved by Representative Erickson. Representative Erickson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. House File 511 is called a mandate relief bill. It is the downsizing of about 100 mandates that were submitted to us during the interim and at the beginning of this session for relief. For the most part, they come from superintendents and school boards and other interested school folk. And Mr. Chair, I do have a couple of amendments. One is technical in nature.
Okay. Representative Erickson, which amendment do you wish to move first?
I will move the... well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to ask Ms. Larson to comment on which one is the latest. I'm seeing time designations, but I do believe that... the A8 and the A9, maybe she could advise me as to...
Okay, Ms. Larson.
Representative Erickson, it is the A9, not the A8. The only difference between the two amendments is that the A9 also amends the head note, and as you know, the head note has no force or effect in law, but it is better to have everything consistent. And so that's the A9 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Erickson.
Thank you, Ms. Larson and Mr. Chair. Then I'll move the A9 amendment. It's a technical amendment, more or less, to clarify that technology can be used in regard to the use of audio and visual when conducting school board meetings that comply with the other requirements of the law.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. A9 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, the A7 amendment I don't think is needed, but for comfort language, Food Service has asked that they not be included in the list of transfers that could occur. I did not find them after consulting with Mr. Crow. I don't think he found them referenced either in the list of funds that can be transferred. But just in case, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A7 amendment, which means that no funds could be transferred out of the Food Service Fund.
Is there any discussion to the A7 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A7 amendment is adopted.
And, Mr. Chair, that puts my bill in the order in which I'd like it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Erickson. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As I said, this is mandate relief submitted by primarily school boards and superintendents. Section 1 is, as you noted from the amendment, allowing interactive television technology for school boards, or actually a technology. Section 2 is a request that after the commissioner has called for revision and alignment of state standards and graduation requirements consistent with the review cycle, that those standards be reported to us and that we have a chance to hear and understand the direction that a new cycle might take after we originally began a standards-based education some years ago. It also calls for a delay in implementing the social study standards, which are currently under review and revision. Section 3 is allowing school boards of a school district to determine the identity of the number or of the vendors available for the 403B plans in school districts for school employees. Section 4 deals with community education directors and allowing for a population, total population of a district to allow for some flexibility in the hiring of a director of community education. Section 5 is rulemaking that has to do with special education, limiting it to technical changes. Section 6 deals with safe school levies and is Representative Depke's bill that deletes or repeals, I should say, the maintenance of effort. Section 7 is a temporary suspension of staff development set aside. Section 8 is the fund transfer to which I referred earlier with the amendment from food service being enacted. And Section 9 is a repeal of the January 15th deadline and penalty. So that, Mr. Chair, in a nutshell, is House File 511.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Members of the committee, any comments or discussion? I guess, first of all, I should take up the, we have an A6 amendment here. Is there a member of the committee who wishes to offer that amendment? No? Okay. We don't dispense with all the amendments then. Testimony, or at this point, we'll take public testimony. This is a public hearing. If there are members of the public who wish to testify either for or voice concerns about the bill, we'll take the pro testifiers first. Ms. Dozlin, I believe you have someone with us today. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Katie Williams, and I'm the current community education director for Hopkins Public Schools and the president of the Minnesota Community Education Association. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to be with you today and testify specifically about Subdivision 3, the community education director licensure issue, and the change in some of that language. On behalf of Minnesota Community Education Association and our 1,400 members, we are opposed to the proposed change that would raise the minimum district population from the current 2,000 to 10,000. A licensed competent director, specifically trained in the principles and practices of community education, bring a unique and practical knowledge of best practices in community education, community involvement, engagement, financing, personnel, legal issues, and the program scope that meets every community's needs. These issues, among others, are why it's critically important to have a licensed director administering a program in each of our school communities. Licensed school administrators are required to demonstrate proficiency in about 100 competencies, and of these, 84 are core competencies, and they're identical for all of the licensed positions in school districts: principal, superintendent, the special education director, and the community ed director. We currently have statutes and rules that emphasize the unique circumstances of each educational program, and for that specific reason, the state of Minnesota has recognized that there is special training required for each of these administrative positions. Currently, there are 49 school districts that have populations 2,000 or less, and raising the ceiling to 10,000 would allow 236 school districts out of 340 to operate a community education program without a licensed, trained community education professional. We submit to you that the result would be a dramatic drop in programming for both youth and adults across the state of Minnesota. We can make a correlation based on data collected by the Department of Education that districts, when they invest in a licensed director specifically for community education, produce not only more programming and community engagement, but they're also meeting the needs of those communities that do not have a director. Community education directors are required by state law to monitor and maintain community education funds and all reserves, and are specifically trained for this oversight. As a statewide program, Community Education and its professionals manage about $39 million in local levy and aid from the state that is entrusted to us by our taxpayers. The good news, however, about community education is that this amount provides well over $264 million in services and programs from preschoolers to senior citizens, a 675% return on your investment. We're a good return on investment program in the state of Minnesota. This investment provides currently in about 900,000 adults, 1.7 million youth, and 285,000 preschool children annually across the state of Minnesota. Well, why would there be a change now? We would submit that this change in law is unnecessary. There already is a provision in state law that allows for a school district to request a waiver from the Board of School Administrators if a district cannot find a qualified candidate. In 2008, a review of waivers, only 10 school districts requested a waiver of letter of approval for the community education director position, and of those 10, 9 were approved and 1 was denied. In that same time period, there were 14 principal variances requested, 11 superintendent variances, and 18 special education director variances. Currently, there are only 4 school districts that have a waiver or variance for community education director position. One assumes then that there are 336 districts who meet that current statute. Based on this information, there appears to be no reason for a change in our statute language. I also have a number of quotes from my colleagues in Greater Minnesota representing Waseca, Rockford, Laverne, Eden Valley, who would also testify here today if they could get here, about the quality of their programming and the amount of revenue that they would generate as a result of having a licensed director in their community. When the superintendent or a principal takes over those responsibilities, often the amount of time it takes to run a school or run a school district overtakes the ability to do the programming, the involvement, and the engagement of the community to use those funds appropriately. And so for that reason, we request that this number continue to stay at 2,000. Community education delivers a sense of community spirit by encouraging active participation in their local communities. And this happens because of quality leadership that is fully trained. And thank you for the time to testify before you, and I'd entertain any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions for the testifier? Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, apologies. Mr. Chairman. To Representative Erickson, line 4.15, would this be an additional job for a principal, or would they be hired just for this job? I'm a bit confused as to your intent here with this provision.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a Representative. It could be either. This is a request that came from us school boards wanting flexibility, and they did not indicate to me whether they would use someone who's already on staff or hire someone who may apply with those credentials. I think they're seeking to get away from waivers. Waivers, they're not complicated, but they take time and they have to be renewed, and so this was just a suggestion they had if they could have some relief, especially in smaller school districts.
Representative Anderson? Okay. Again, this is a public hearing, so we'll continue to take testimony from the public. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. We just would like to testify briefly in support of continuing to keep this provision in the mandate repeal bill. We have surveyed our rural superintendents once again and asked them their opinion on this issue. They want to see this number raised significantly. They would mostly prefer it be a set at 10,000. They'd be willing to compromise a little bit. The reality is for many of our small districts, we do not need to employ a full-time person in community ed, and we're finding that we simply can't find part-time people. I have reports from districts where they're advertising these positions and nobody is coming forward on a part-time basis. They don't have the money for a full-time job. So here's what's really going on. For many of these small districts, they are running their community education directors with other administrators. Then they are turning to some other regional community ed director and saying, we'll contract with you for $800 or $1,000, sign our forms off so that we're quote-unquote legal. So we've kind of got a whole kind of scheme going out here that is costing the districts money, putting them through a number of hurdles. They're not going through the waiver process. They're using this other process I just referred to. We think that this number simply should be larger, and it would allow us to be more efficient. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional public testimony? Oh, Representative Dietrich, did you have a question? My apologies.
Yes, no, and it's just a general one. So if we're done with testimony, okay. I think let's go ahead.
We'll take
it. I'll go later.
Okay. Ms. Allswager's here, so all those in favor of the bill, please signify by saying. I'm just kidding, Jen. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. It's great to keep a sense of humor. I'm going to pass out a document a little bit. I think that it's probably going to be one of the number one documents distributed in the legislative session. If I would get the page to take it. I'm going to testify briefly on just four issues, three issues, and put a little more time into a fourth issue. One of the provisions that is repealed in here is the January 15th contract settlement deadline. It's been before you before, so I won't spend much time on it. And I think that Representative Downey's bill will be brought up as well. So I think I'll just leave the comments about January 15th until we get to Representative Downey's bill. There is another provision in here that is repealed as well that is important to talk about, and that's the repeal of the staff development set-aside. Or later this week, you will hear Representative Brandon Peterson's bill on teacher evaluation. I just want to remind individuals that when you're looking at trying to improve the teaching profession, let's just say through using teacher evaluation, Representative Peterson, I know that you've got the right intentions and the right goals in trying to evaluate teachers, and we support teacher evaluation. But along with that, then, you do need to have some kind of staff development support that educators can count on. And so we would strongly urge you not to repeal that, as well as QComp. QComp is a provision. I know that Representative Erickson has a QComp bill that would make some changes. Whether that passes or not, today we don't know. But whether it does or not, QComp is in law. And will continue at least to be in law for some, in some shape or manner. And again, staff development is very important. And also, we would oppose the repeal of a safe schools levy. I'm going to spend most of my time then talking about Section 3, because this is an issue that I have not been able to address this committee on. This refers to the 403B contributions from a school district. And I would like to start out by giving you some history. It used to be that if a school employee wanted to contribute money to a 403B, which would be similar to the 401K in the private sector, that the school employee could name the vendor, and then the school district would work with that vendor to make sure that all the contributions, et cetera, went through. And there were some situations where school employees had quite a few vendors to choose from. There have been third-party administrators, et cetera, to help ease those costs and have done a very good job. But a few years ago, the Osseo School District decided, no, we're not going to let our school employees have the choice to whichever vendor they want. And so they unilaterally decided to go to one vendor. Well, the teachers' union in Osseo and Education Minnesota filed a lawsuit, and we lost because the law clearly did not say that you could not winnow it down to one.
The
so
law said you could not.
You could. I'm sorry. Did
okay,
I
you could. Okay.
Thank, yep. Misspeak. Thank you. So that you could do that according to the current law. So we were able to be successful and passed a law that we think is actually a very good compromise. that now instead of having a school district just be able to pick one on their own, or to have the school employees pick 20 as an option, that it would become a subject of collective bargaining. So if you look at on this document, let's see, on lines 3.24 to 3.26, you will see, if you look at the current law, that it said that the identity and the number of the vendors would be a subject of term and condition of employment, so it would be collectively bargained. What does that do? Once you put the discussion and the decision-making in the hands of the employer and the employee, you now have shared fiduciary responsibility, because both parties have a stake in this and they have to make a decision. If this were to be passed as law, now the employees would have no say in who those vendors are. We are now shifting the fiduciary responsibility onto the employer. I don't think that's the direction that we want to go. In addition, it could be more expensive if an employer is then going to have to issue RFPs, because RFPs actually have a cost to them. And so now we actually might be increasing these costs to a school district. In the other committee, we had, in one of the committees that this bill has been through, a third-party administrator actually said that the law as it currently is, not as written here as a proposal, has actually saved money, and that this would probably be more costly to school districts. In addition, I would remind you that the money that is contributed to a 403B is the employee's money. 100% of it is the employee's money. There may be a $200 contribution from the district, and there may be a $1,000 contribution from the employee. But no matter what, it is 100% the employee's money.
So, Elsmeyer, for those members who don't serve on the tax committee, can you just briefly explain what a 403B is?
Yes, the 403B is a tax-deferred annuity. I think that's the best way to describe it. That is similar to, in the private sector, a 401K. So a 403B is like a defined contribution amount that you set aside, and if the stock market goes up or the bond market goes up, then you get those contributions, and it's something in addition that superintendents negotiate this, principals negotiate this, teachers, custodians, food service. So we believe, because it is 100% the employee's money, that they, one, should have a say in it, that they should have a say in it in two ways, the identity and the vendors that they would pick. We're not saying that there should be 25, but we don't think that a district should be able to go down to one all on their own. So we would strongly encourage you to let the school employees at least have some voice in the money that they are contributing. I think if you were one of those school employees, you would want to have some sort of say in that as well. So we would ask you to delete Section 2 from the bill.
Thank you. Is there any questions from members of the committee? Representative Loon. Oh, I'm sorry, hold on. Representative Huam first, then Loon.
Section 3, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am very pleased that Ms. Allswager likes defined contribution plans. I was just, in this discussion, we've neglected that there is a cost if you have multiple plans. There are commissions, and that varies by the amount of participation. So if the more plans you have, there tends to be an inherent cost. That is not a universal thing. But also, if you look in the private sector, they don't have multiple plans. They have what they consider is the best one that they can get, And frequently these multiple plans offer some of the same vehicles and funds and et cetera, so that in the past, being on a school board, we noticed that there were duplicative funds and it was costing us more money, and that's probably part of the reason why the School Board Association prefers having it limited. And I really don't see a negative impact to having a pared down set of options. So I don't see a cost benefit to having more options, and I guess I support this section.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this question is really, I guess, to whoever could answer it, whether it's Ms. Alzweiger or our research staff. I'm just curious, in the private sector, and if the workforce in the private sector is unionized, is this a typical practice where the employee bargaining unit is involved in selecting vendors or not?
Well, Ms. Alzweiger, I'm assuming that there are probably some that are, some that aren't. Do you feel comfortable addressing that in a more specific manner or fashion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I am not an expert in the private sector, but I think that whether it be a 401k or a 403b, there are many of these proposals and these plans available to employees. And I don't know that I can answer specifically the remainder of your question.
Representative Loon, do you have a follow-up or not?
Well, no, just I'm thinking, in the 401k world, at least in the private sector that I'm familiar with, employees don't really get the choice of who the vendor is for providing those. You get choices as an employee where you want to direct perhaps your contributions and that, but in terms of selecting who the vendor is that the employer works with, that's not a choice. So I'm just wondering if that's a difference in a workplace where there's collective bargaining or not.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in response to that, Representative Loon, as far as I know, every company I've been involved with, it's not a choice. It is designated, but that's just my own personal experience. But Ms. Alzweiger, can you give me an idea of how many vendors really provide this service in the state of Minnesota, maybe a couple of examples of vendors that provide this for teachers?
Ms. Alzweiger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Woodard, I really am not an expert on the vendors that are out there. I do know that one thing that we have heard from our members is that when there is a few, and I do want to make sure that we're not advocating for 20 vendors or 10 vendors. We are advocating only that it be a subject of collective bargaining. So if they decided to go to one vendor, that's not a problem, but the employees should have a say in that. And Representative Woodard, I forgot the rest of your question. Could you repeat the rest of it?
Representative Woodard,
do you have an example of a company that does that? So is Education Minnesota involved in that process too? Or?
Ms. Elsweger.
There are some. Education Minnesota does have education services incorporated, I think it's called. Yes, they do have something, but it's separate, somewhat connected to the union. But I would tell you that we're not there to say it should be that vendor at all. We are here to say that it should be locally negotiated. We're not trying to advocate for one or the other, not at all. We just only want it to be a subject of collective bargaining so that there's a decision that is mutually agreed upon and that there is shared fiduciary responsibility. But I'm really glad you asked that question.
So, Representative Woodard?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, but I just want to make sure maybe I misunderstood the question or misunderstood the answer. Are we saying that Education Minnesota provides 403B plan administration services?
Mr. Chair, Education Minnesota as a organization itself does not, but there is a kind of an affiliate, Education, and I'm not an expert on this, but we can get somebody here to talk about it if you needed that to be the case.
Okay, but I don't want to dig too deep in this. do they have like a subsidiary of education? Is this, because I thought I misunderstood the question, and I thought I misunderstood the answer, but you guys really do that? You have like a subsidiary that plans those? Representative Kwan, do you have subject matter experts? I see you nodding your head. Can you elaborate on this just a little bit? Or
That was my understanding, but I haven't been involved for some time.
Okay. Well, perhaps if we don't have experts on site, we can maybe look at that at a future time. But so, okay, Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really an interesting conversation we're having, trying to blend private sector employment with public sector employment. And no matter how hard you try, it doesn't work unless the agenda is to eliminate collective bargaining in the public sector. You're also going to try to eliminate collective bargaining in the private sector. And at the end of the day, the result is the same. But to assume that where there are collective bargaining agreements in place, that employees don't have an open, free choice, democratic opportunity to choose vendors is just preposterous. That is the function of a union. You give workers the choice rather than the employer. And what you call balance is actually imbalance. You would tilt the playing field in the collective bargaining process away from one of equality at the local level, at the bargaining table, and you would, to use one of your favorite words, you would impose a mandate on all these school districts. You know, the public is watching this, and I would caution us about trying to move to a one-size-fits-all labor management relationship, public sector over here, private sector over there. It doesn't work, and it's counterproductive.
Done? Representative Anzels, do you have any more? Okay, thank you. Representative Ward.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just do, I didn't know Representative Anzels was going to talk before me and talk about some things that I was going to address, but I will expound on what he had kind of talked about in a minute ago. two phrases come to my mind, local control, which a lot of folks in here talk about, and free market, which a lot of folks talk about in here. And, I've been on some committees in my district that decided which vendors we were going to use in the districts that I've been in. And there is a process. You know, usually it goes through a thing called meet and confer, when the management of the district and the union folk in the district get together and hash things out, talk about, you know, how we can, without going through a negotiations process, how we can come up with some agreements on issues. And this is one of the issues that often comes to meet and confer. And so the district management and the union folk get together and talk about, well, what do our employees, including our management level, including our custodial level, including our food service level, including our educator teacher level, including all levels that we have here and all sectors that we have here, what are the individual needs of that district that would be better met by the local kind of companies that offer these plants? And so the districts that I've sat on and the meet and confer that I've sat on, you know, look at all options available within the district, and then they put an application out. Then they put the word out to the local businesses that want to bid on this or want to apply for having their business in the district. And there have to be In the Brainerd School District, there have to be at least, it was 5, maybe it went to 10, I don't remember the exact number right now, but there had to be a number of employees that said, okay, we want to use that vendor, before that vendor was allowed to come in and participate. It was, again, a free market thing that a lot of folk around here talk about. So there is a process that works very well. It meets the needs of the individual employees and employer in the district, and it best suits our free market within our own communities, thereby again investing in our own communities and having a free market kind of discussion and a competitive kind of discussion, and not creating a monopoly with one vendor. So I wanted to make sure that that's the process that I'm familiar with, and it is a process that has worked well for the years that I've been involved in that as well. So I wanted to make sure that that was dialogued.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little curious as to why this seems to be a big issue, because I don't see where a proper just business management approach makes this an overwhelming issue with collective bargaining, because from my understanding it revolved more around an IRS ruling that said the plan document of a 403B must be compliant. In other words, if you had 20 different vendors at a school, the IRS ruled that they all have to comply with the same plan document. Well, certainly not all companies were doing that. So this was more about the ease of operation. So as we evolved in the business of the investment side, these variable annuities now decided we'll have one variable annuity and we will encompass 25 different mutual fund companies. So now the choice is, yes, it's under the umbrella of the tax-deferred annuity, but every individual who participates in the plan now has an option from probably 25 different vendors. And if you want to know the names, they're American Funds, it's ING, it's Fidelity, it's T. Rowe Price. It's every vendor out there under one umbrella. So we're not taking away choice here of the individual. It's simply about a business practice and management that says now the management team can put in this product, comply with the IRS rulings, and have one plan document. So I don't quite understand the idea that we're so upset that this is the issue we fight against.
Greiling as well. Just a quick question before I go to Representative Anzels, I guess for House staff, or actually I'll wait, never mind. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kelly, you used the term management team. That tells me that you're assuming that this is an inherent managerial right to do the selecting. And this is nothing more, nothing less than taking away the right of the workers collectively at the table to have a voice. What can be so wrong with that?
Representative Kelly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anzels, that's not what I'm saying. If you want to give the right, now what you're giving the right to is to put in two tax-deferred annuities that offer two 25-itemed mutual funds. They would be nearly identical. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Representative Anzels?
We disagree.
Thank you. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I always feel like in this committee I've already made my points in the policy committee, but then I realize we're in a different committee and some of the legislators are different. And so I was only listening to this with half an ear, but then I heard Representative Kelly saying that there would be choice and the school boards could provide it and so forth. And so I just want to make the point that I did make already in the policy committee. This is the teachers' money. We are going in the direction with retirement funds of trying to have retirees or pending retirees or people saving for retirement to be responsible with their money and plan ahead. And this is a very patronizing model that takes it away from the teachers, even though it is their money, and gives it to the school boards who don't have a vested interest in if it does well or not. And the reason we have this law, which is very short-lived, it's only been in law, I think, a couple years, is because of a problem that we had with one school district that went down to only having one plan for the teachers to pick from. And that was a problem, and that shows how much that local school district cared about choice. I think it was Representative Depke's district. I think it was Orono. And Osseo, thank you. Oreo, Osseo.
Oreo.
Or Orono. One of those O's. But anyway, the point is, we changed this law for a reason. I think it was a very good reason, and I think we should be always fostering everybody to be planning for retirement and paying attention to it themselves. I know I do.
Where'd Ms. Allswager go? Welcome to the... I had a question for you, Ms. Allswager, before... So you're not Ms. Allswager. So under current law, if the members, if I can understand this right, do individual employees get to choose where the plans are, or does the union negotiate what the individual plans are going to be?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it would be a subject of collective bargaining, so that they would determine the number of vendors and which vendors were available. An individual employee cannot choose which vendor they want from the, you know, 50 or 100 vendors that might be out there. That used to be the law, and then there was a lawsuit, and then we thought that this current law was a compromise. I just want to point out that really this is all about the teacher's voice. That's all it is. I want you to think about the legislation that's before this committee. Staff development, no teacher voice. January 15th, taking away teacher's voice. Wage freeze, taking away teacher's voice, and thank you, Representative Downing, for pulling the school employees out. 403B, taking away the teacher's voice. This is what it's about. Let us collectively bargain. It just seems to be quite a trend here. Thank you very much. I meant that in the nicest possible way.
So regarding the teacher's voice then, if let's say I'm a teacher and I disagree with the plan options that my coworkers negotiate for me, what is my choice?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. You know, in a teacher's union or any other school employee union, you do not have 100% harmony. And if you don't like what the teacher's union has negotiated, you tell them about it. And if the school board members who aren't on the negotiations team doesn't like what the school board negotiations team did, or if the public doesn't, you tell them about it. We can't get 100% of agreement in every group, not at Education Minnesota, not on this committee, not in your caucus. That's the way it is. But when you have a democratic process and everybody knows what the rules are, the process works. Collective bargaining works. Personalities can make things challenging, whether it's administrators or teachers, but it works, and it gives people a say, and the fiduciary responsibility is on both sides.
Ms. Allswager, is it a fair statement that if I'm a school teacher and I disagree with the plan options that my union has negotiated for me, that I don't have a choice? Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that if you were upset about it, that you talk to your union leadership. Go ahead, and if you wanted to run for one of the offices in the union, you have a choice. Be a worksite rep. Be a building steward. You have a say.
Right, but under the if I'm under a collective bargaining agreement, and I because you said it's about the teacher's voice. Those were your words, not mine. Under the teacher's voice stipulation you're talking about, if I belong to a collective bargaining unit, and as part of that agreement, I disagree with my options that are before me, do I have a choice of picking another plan? Because it seems to me, I mean, I think the answer to that is no. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I think that if you don't like the plan, the next time you have a vote, you vote for leadership in the union or in the collective bargaining team to find somebody who reflects your views. Same with the school board member. They don't have the individuals who negotiate for the school board voiced their opinion when they came to an agreement. They can make a choice as well. So this is, through the collective bargaining process, you do have a voice. The legislation that's before you, the teachers and the school employees, would not have a voice.
By a voice, you mean that my coworkers can tell me what to do?
Because each of the members elected those individuals on the negotiations team. Absolutely, they have a voice.
Representative Anzels, or Representative Kelly, to this point. No.
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, you know, we are really at a fundamental philosophical crossroads here. And I wouldn't have expected that this conversation would start here, but it's certainly going to continue bubbling throughout the rest of the session. I have great respect for you, and I have great respect for the way you run this committee. And you run it in a democratic fashion, just like the Laborers Union conducts its business in a democratic manner, just like Education Minnesota functions in a democratic manner. There is a majority and there is a minority. And the role of the minority in a million different issues here in the committee and in the school district is to try to convince the majority of the minority's wishes, of the minority's opinion. It's called democracy. And to suggest, Mr. Chairman, that there's a difference between the union, this monolithic institution that some of us don't like, there's no difference between the union and the members. The members are the union. And within the membership, there's a majority and a minority on hundreds of different issues. That's the way it works. So why not let some sunshine in and allow workers an equal opportunity at the bargaining table in every school district to make these decisions, instead of going down this reckless path, very reckless, of taking away the rights of teachers and other workers in school districts to participate in the decision-making process. That's what you're doing. The public is watching. And I would caution you about the speed at which you're traveling down this road.
Representative Plum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through this discussion, I got the epiphany that we should give teachers some choice where they have no choice, and that is, you know, if they chose a different union or chose to not join a union nor pay 85% of the union dues, that they ought to have that freedom and choice. So, you know, I think you've won me over on the point that teachers don't have sufficient choice. Because there are hundreds of teachers I've talked to over the years that wish they had a choice of a different union or a choice of not participating in a union. So if you have an amendment to add that choice, I would like to support that.
We'll go to Representative Bills, and then Ms. Allswag, you want to make a comment after that? Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Allswager, so if a union member would maybe not on collective bargaining or not on collective bargaining or the 403, the investments would offer their views to their leadership and their union, and then be sent an opt-out form, what would you suggest to that union member?
Ms. Allswager.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bills, I don't know about the particular situation or if that is a real situation, but I think that I'd be more than happy to figure out. I really don't understand exactly what you're talking about.
Mr.
Chairman,
Bills. If a teacher would offer their views on certain subjects, politically or otherwise, and continue to have discussions with their leadership and their union, and then the response to their concerns, and maybe you're doing that really frequently, and maybe it's becoming a headache for someone, and that leadership person would send them a form to opt out of the union, because then, you know, clearly your voice isn't heard anymore, but the union still gets 85% of my dues. How would that union member feel? What should they do next?
Ms. Allswager.
Well, I guess in some ways I would say that the union leader is providing the options that are available to the individual, and I think that that's a very transparent and upfront way of dealing with it. Now, whether you and I agree it's the right way to do it or what is the best process, I don't know enough about it. But I think that a union leader saying that you can be a member or cannot, you don't have to be a member, is a very forthright thing to say to somebody.
Representative Bills?
I just don't think... thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And I've heard opinions before, so I'll offer mine again. So I don't think that it's the same situation completely walking away with no dues, if you will, than to say, okay, well, I'm out now, and I still have to pay 85% of $744, and I just lost my protection if something would ever go catastrophically wrong, whether it was my fault or not. And that's the protection that you lose if you opt out and you reduce that 15%, that's what you get. So those are my concerns, so I guess my question. So.
Representative Woodard.
Just a real quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson.
Ooh, those are fighting words, Representative Woodard.
Bad start. just to the point that we're discussing here, when the school boards make this decision, teachers still will have the ability to address the school board on this decision-making process and still be able to ask questions and be a part of that democratic process. Is that correct
yes,
the way the bill is written?
Mr. Chair and Representative Woodard, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Mariani?
Mr. Chair, just a couple of things very quickly. You know, we apparently are having the hearing that you had tried to have a couple of weeks ago, and frankly, I thought that would have been a good hearing, which is to have a very in-depth discussion about collective bargaining and collective bargaining in our public K-12 system. We're having it right now, and, you know, we actually need more time, apparently, to have that conversation because I do see several bolts kind of missing each other, you know, in the dark here. And, you know, we're probably going to continue to have this conversation on a per-bill basis. And perhaps, you know, in the interim, it might be a good, you know, opportunity for us to have even much deeper conversations. My very quick observation on this is that it seems to me on the issue of the teacher's voice that, you know, the fact that teachers are citizens notwithstanding, there is no voice if the determiner the only determiner is the group of people that they're typically on the other side of the table negotiating with, or at least meeting and conferring with. It sure sounds like it is a sloppy process. Democracy is, in fact, that. But I am convinced that there is a legitimate teacher's voice, even when you're in a minority. At least that's what I'm getting out of this conversation. But, Mr. Chair, if I can quickly just switch subject, because I know that we're moving on to the, you know, getting late in the hearing, I want to talk about Section 2 very quickly. And instead of asking questions, I guess I'll just make a statement because I don't want to bog us down, Mr. Chair. You know, Representative Erickson, I fail to understand how Section 2 has anything to do with mandate reform, and I certainly would love to hear from MSBA, MASA, any of the other organizations here representing our schools, and have them explain to me how Section 2 is mandate reform that they're looking. I will caution us, members, and I mean this sincerely, that you know, Representative Erickson, you and we spoke a little bit about this in policy committee. You expressed that your desire with Section 2 is to, and I think it's a good desire, is for the legislature to have reported back from the commissioner for us to hear and understand, you know, as we, you know, continually cycle through and update our standards. However, I have to tell you, I don't think that's what the language says here. I'm really uncomfortable with the language that says receiving specific legislative authority to go ahead and adopt these revised and aligned standards. And then we see the same, you know, language later on in regards to the specifically the social studies, where legislature will be recommending any where revisions will be recommended to the legislature. And members, I could just see a nightmare here of members coming in with individual amendments to the standards, especially on the social studies standards. It's what we've seen happen in Texas. We've seen it in Arizona. It's incredibly destructive. It's why we set these cycles into place, 10 years ago or so, was precisely to avoid what we had slipped into a decade ago, which was to become this place where we were playing out our worst ideological differences at the expense of setting clear, timely, high standards for our students so that our teachers can quickly move to instruct them on this. And so, Representative Erickson, I would urge you, depending on what happens with this bill, to seriously reconsider this Section 2. I don't think there's mandate reform here. I suspect if we were to call down any of the organizations I called out, that they would probably say, you know, we have some really legitimate mandate reform issues. This is in that category. And I think we're biting off something here that we can terribly regret later on.
Thank you. Well, members, this is we still are taking public testimony, so the man who is not Ms. Allswager can testify now. Or if we have any other members of the public who wish to testify, either for or have concerns about this bill. Dr. Roberts, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Walter Roberts. I am a professor of counselor education at Minnesota State University Mankato, and I'm here today to talk again, but make some different points about the efforts to repeal the maintenance of effort language that is in House File 511. I have 4 points and 3 recommendations, and I promise to be brief. First, as we know, the original effort to establish some sort of maintenance of effort was to keep a bad situation from getting worse. School counselors in Minnesota in particular are stretched beyond human limits when it comes to responding to the needs of students today. And these services are K-12 in scope. Contrary to some information that was floating around after debate last week, there are elementary school counselors in the state employed throughout Minnesota. And school counselors at all grade levels are trained in the areas of career, academic, and personal aspects of child and adolescent development. The tradition and primary focus of school counseling is on prevention, helping students before we get to the issue of having to intervene or remediate. And it's not just restricted to high school students. It's not just about post-secondary planning. School counselors in Minnesota are licensed K-12. Counselor education programs prepare our students to work in all school settings at these grade levels. What has happened is that school counselors have been placed in a, and student services personnel have been placed in a defensive posture. It's very, very difficult, if not almost impossible, for prevention and wellness education to be a part of the overall school curriculum when caseloads continue to rise above staffing needs, particularly in the student services arena. And although school counselors serve all students in the school setting, districts do not necessarily receive reimbursement for school counselors at the same levels that they do for some particular groups within that pool, particularly school social workers and school psychologists. I mention this because you might not be aware that the funding stream for reimbursement that is made available to school districts is necessarily equivalent across the board. And at the very least, I would urge the committee that if you're going to repeal maintenance of effort, that you look at this funding structure inequity among the student services pool. The third point I would like to make is that the issues with which student services personnel respond to are oftentimes a matter of life and death. While teachers love their students, my wife is a teacher. I was a teacher at one point in time. But I can tell you what student services personnel do is specifically what they're placed in school to do, which is assist the teachers to respond to, or assist students and families to respond to many of the issues that the average classroom teacher is not prepared to respond to and is outside the scope of their practice. addressing high-risk student need is also not about allowing just anyone to try and respond to many of the issues that our young people have. Many times in our school districts today, we have, I think, a question sometimes with regard to exactly who is allowed to provide some of these student personnel services. And I can tell you that, from my opinion, that's an accident waiting to happen, as well as the long-term damage that it can do to kids whenever they receive inadequate counseling or student service provision from individuals who are untrained or unskilled to do so. The last point I would like to make before my recommendations are that you may have heard in floor debate last week and among other individuals that have testified before this committee earlier that repeal of the maintenance of effort language as contained in 511 will lift an impediment to the hiring of more student services personnel. I hope that's the case. If the repeal goes through, however, I strongly urge this body to monitor that situation to see whether or not that is actually the case, whether or not that actually does become the case. And also, I would also encourage those individuals who support the repeal of the maintenance of effort to offer some credible solutions to address this problem across the board, particularly as it relates to school counseling. My three recommendations are as follows, because I don't like to just testify and not offer solutions. Option one would obviously be to keep the current maintenance of effort statute in place while we design a mechanism to make the current system better, particularly with regard to licensed school counselor. Option two is to look at restructuring the current funding mechanism so that there is a level playing field when it comes to allowing schools to hire student services personnel within the student services personnel pool. And option three would be for the Department of Education to study the problem with regard to the inequity of services in the state and report back to this committee and the legislature at the start of the 2012 legislative session. I, of course, will do what I can to help both the legislature and to study this issue or make other recommendations, and I will remain to answer. I thank you for this opportunity, and I will remain around to answer any questions that may come up.
Did you have any additional testimony as well?
Yeah, and I'll be very brief. As most of you know, I'm Chris Moe. I'm the president of the Minnesota School Counselors Association. You've heard me testify that, you know, we're 49th in the nation. We've got a number of suicides, a number of suicide attempts that are going on in Minnesota. You've heard all my testimony. So I'm just here to basically piggyback off of what Dr. Walter Roberts has to say, and that we hope you keep the maintenance of effort language in. And if, you know, we've got two other bills out there where it passed that to repeal it. So what we're asking for is that if it is going to be repealed, can we work with you to find some other solutions to help out our students in the state of Minnesota because of the growing number of mental health issues they're dealing with? With that being said, thank you.
Thank you. Is there any additional testimony from members of the public? Yep. And now in the... Before we take your final point here, because you're offering a little bit of a rebuttal, are there any other members of the public who wish to testify for or have concerns about this bill? Okay, so we'll close the public comments portion of this, but go ahead. This will be not that we want to get back and forth between rebuttals on this issue, but please welcome to the committee, and once again, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name again is Katie Williams, president of the Minnesota Community Education Association. I simply wanted to take a minute and comment on Mr. Kite's testimony. He alluded to the practice of community education directors that are getting paid in rural communities and signing off on state annual reports other than their own district report, I presume. On behalf of Minnesota Community Education Association, we certainly would not condone this practice. I personally am not aware of this practice and would love to see some evidence so that we could clean it up if that were the case. For your information, what happens on an annual basis, the State Department of Education has an annual community education report. The community education director, the superintendent, and the community chair of the advisory council must sign off on that report on an annual basis. I would suggest to you that if this practice is occurring, that this is a violation of state law and really isn't an issue that's addressed in House File 511. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. With no other testimony, then, Representative Erickson, my understanding is there's a technical change that's needed to the A9 amendment, so I think the proper way to do this is we'll just move reconsideration of the A9 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. So now the A9 amendment is against in front of us before, and you have two changes you'd like to make to that, Representative Erickson. Do you have those changes in front of you?
Mr. Chair, I would move to delete on page 2, line 36, the phrase, and recommend any
Representative,
revisions.
Hold on, Representative Erickson. We are running off a different script here. I have the A9 amendment in front of me that there are... line 28 is supposed to be changed to line 27. Line 29 is supposed to be changed to line 28 on lines 1.6
yes,
and 1.7.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Yes, that
okay.
is correct.
So Representative Erickson moves the A9 amendment with the, or an amendment to the A9 amendment
yes,
that
Mr.
line 1.6, line 28 is changed to line 27, and line 1.7, line 29 is changed to line 28. Any discussion? Seeing none on the... we incorporate this amendment?
Yes,
is that correct?
Mr. Chair.
Okay, so all those in favor on the A9 amendment as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A9 amendment is adopted as amended.
And, Mr. Chair, I just have an oral amendment that I'd like to present. On page 2, line 36, after school year, delete and recommend any revisions to at the top of page 3, legislature. That's the first word on line 1. And then we'll have probably some conclusion to some of this concern that I've heard. There is no intent on my part to recommend any revisions to the legislature when the social studies standards are ready to be implemented.
Mr. Chair.
1 second here. Before mm-hmm. we take questions on this, the staff have the amendment as Representative Erickson's presented it. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for the author. I know that Assistant Commissioner Hermanson and you have had some conversations about the department's concern with this language. I won't attempt to characterize it because I don't think I could do it fairly. Does this amendment that you're proposing now move towards agreement with the department and hopefully allay their concerns?
Representative
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor, any other discussion on the oral amendment from Representative Erickson? Seeing none, Representative Briner.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, and I maybe could have asked this independently of that, but I meant the relationship between line 2.26 and line 1.22, at the end of 1.2, it says, without first receiving specific legislative authority to do so. So am I understanding your intention correct here, Representative Erickson, to be that legislative authority is simply moving forward with the standards as proposed? It's an issue of the timeline and not the content?
Correct. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Any other discussion to the Erickson oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there any additional questions from members of the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I have a concern on page 4, the community education piece as well, and we heard testimony that the administrators would like to see that number raised from its present 2,000 to a somewhat higher number. I would ask the author if she would look favorably on lowering that 10,000 figure down a bit, or if she wants to continue with that number of 10,000.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I believe that 8,000 would probably be acceptable at this stage. I've had that conversation with Charlie Kite, however, not with anyone else, so... I'm not sure how the community education directors feel about that reduction, but that might be more in line with the concerns that have come from school districts.
Representative Anderson.
I would offer that as an oral amendment, Mr. Chairman, to...
Mr. Chair, I'll incorporate that unless I hear something different from anyone in the audience.
Representative Erickson, Representative Anderson, we do have... an amendment, a 24-hour amendment policy. If the author wants to, I want to certainly give the author authority to have the bill in the form they would like. Representative Greiling, are you okay with this?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any additional discussion? Representative Kwan.
Where does this bill, again, proceed to?
Representative Erickson, this bill goes to Ways and Means from here, is that correct?
That's correct.
Representative Kwan.
Mr. Chair, because it was stated by the author that she has not had discussion with more than one party, and since this is, I think, less than trivial, if we're going to fine-tune that number, I'd prefer if the author had more complete discussions, and that could maybe be done in the next committee as opposed to on the fly here. So I would not support this, voting for this amendment.
Representative Quam, as I learned in previous terms, the custom and usage of this committee and the body is that the author has the bill in the form they want it. So Representative Erickson, it's your call. What do you say?
You know, Mr. Chair, I like what I'm hearing from our new representative who's served on the school board, and I think Representative Quam is right. Maybe I should hear from more before we change that number, because if I get to Ways and Means, if we're changing it again, it's going to seem like this is not the mandate relief that I think some are looking for. So I'll rescind that.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. So Representative Erickson unincorporates the amendment from her bill. Any additional discussion, members? Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now that we're done with the complete policy discussion on the mandate reduction bill, I am just wondering if Representative Erickson has any ballpark, and I don't expect exact numbers, on the cost analysis or cost savings of any of these proposals. For me, that plays a big part when I evaluate each proposal, what would be the cost savings to the state, and then how much of a value do I place on that mandate after we've debated the policy.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dietrich. I think I'm going to turn to Mr. Crow to see if he can give us a ballpark figure. I know it's several million, but...
Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom to the Dietrich question?
Mr. Chair and members, from a state financing standpoint, the only cost piece in here is the repeal of the January 15th deadline, which costs $700,000 on an entitlement basis for the biennium. And I wouldn't hazard a guess on
what local impact you can.
Mr. Crow, go ahead.
On what value or what relief districts would put on some of the other provisions at a local level.
Representative Erickson, did you have something to add?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dietrich, I think that's something that's necessary before I go before Ways and Means, and so I will ask the stakeholders if they could please give us an idea of how much local impact they think this will save. You know, it's going to be questionable because of the fund transfers. We don't have any idea which funds may be transferred, but you ask a very good question. So that's my next homework.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you for this follow-up. And so, Representative Erickson, do you happen to know the annuity contract payroll allocation piece? Does that what kind of cost savings to the district can we expect in that? There was quite a healthy discussion on it, so I'm just wondering what kind of a cost savings does it have to districts?
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'd have to ask someone in the audience to answer that. I don't know.
Is there a member of the public who could offer a specific cost estimate of what a 403B plan revision would save the state of Minnesota or local school districts? Ms. Allswager has an idea. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name again for the record.
Actually, Madam, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. What has happened in Osseo is that a number of members have switched from the 403B to the 457. And as a result, the school districts now have to pay FICA tax. So it actually has increased the costs. And I just learned this just a few minutes ago after we had this discussion. So that has increased. That would increase your costs because the members have decided, okay, well, forget that. We'll go to the 457. And they can do that on their own, and now it's cost the school districts more money. And the January 15th, actually, now this is not necessarily a good thing, but when you have the January 15th contract settlement deadline, it actually saves the state money because there are a few districts that actually get penalized. Again, we don't like that. But this would be an increased cost to the state if you pass this bill in a couple of different ways. Thank you.
Yeah. Are there any other members of the public who have a cost estimate on the 403B provision? Seeing none? Okay. Representative Dietrich, did you have any follow-up question? Or?
No, thank you very much, though. Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank you. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too, am intrigued as to, should this pass and be signed into law, how it will impact the fiscal condition of the districts as well as the state. And the historical data shows that the provision where we're going to remove the deadline date, we have way, way more strikes when we're in a period of not having the deadline. And I'm sure superintendents would be really very willing to share with us some data as to what those strikes cost, because I think that should be factored into as well. More strikes without a deadline. With a deadline, less strikes.
Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, I just wanted to speak and maybe to Representative Mariani's point about Section 2 with the standards. And one little chunk is, you know, from a teacher's perspective and a social studies teacher's perspective, you know, please don't politicize this, and I worry a little bit about pulling it into legislative authority that does happen, and in one cycle we get, you know, President Carter save the day, and in the other cycle we get President Reagan save the day, and that really doesn't do a whole lot for us as teachers. But on a side note, because there's no exams or audit or whatever on social studies, what you find with any faculty or any administration who values academic freedom is teachers typically teach what they're going to teach anyway, and you're relying on an ethical and moral foundation in the classroom to teach everything from, you know, you teach Marx, you teach Smith, you teach Keynes, you teach Austrian school, whatever, and in history the same thing. So that's just my take on that. So.
Thank you. Representative Greiley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to request a roll call, please.
A roll call has been requested. Is there any additional questions or comments from members? Representative Erickson, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for taking a very long time on this bill. I'm afraid that Representative Downey's going to have quite the travel tonight because he's first up in my committee, and I think he's first up in yours as well. So we're going to have to toss a coin.
Well, Representative Downey's a smart guy. He'll accomplish both, I know.
So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I would like to renew my motion that House File 511, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
So moved by Representative Erickson. Are we ready to take the roll? The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
Representative Kelly.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Anzal.
Yet.
Yeah, I know.
That's no. It's like,
no. No.
Representative Bill.
Yes.
Representative Reinhardt.
No.
Representative Dabney.
No.
Representative Dietrich.
No.
Representative Downey.
Yes.
Representative Erickson.
Yes.
Representative Fabian.
Yes.
Representative Greiling.
No.
Representative Loon.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
No.
Representative Myra.
Yes.
Representative Peterson.
Yes.
Representative Quam.
Yeah.
Representative Slocum.
No.
Representative Ward. Excuse. Representative Woodard.
Yes.
I don't know.
There being 12 votes in favor, 7 votes against, the motion prevails. House File 511, as amended, has passed and sent to the Ways and Means Committee. Members, we are going to recess this committee to the call of the chair. We'll be back to take up the Downey bill. I think that's the only item on the agenda for tonight, correct? We will be in room 5. And again, stay tuned to your emails. Recess to the call of the chair. Republican members, we will be meeting in room 500N at 4 p.m. sharp, and you will want to be there at 4 o'clock, Republican members. 4 p.m., 500N. Any additional comments or questions for members? Seeing none, we are recessed to the call of the chair. Members, we'll call the. We will end the recess for the Education Finance Committee and call the meeting to order. Representative Downey, we do not have a quorum present yet, so we are unable to move your bill. We will move that as soon as a quorum is present. So, Representative Downey, you could just briefly explain your bill and maybe explain the A4 amendment, and then once we have a quorum, we'll move on both items.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Some of you have heard this bill already in K-12 Policy Committee, but I'll do a quick walkthrough and explain the A4 amendment, and we can entertain questions and testimony. So the qualified economic offer concept is actually quite straightforward. The basic premise is that in tough times like this, while many of us, myself included, might recognize the merit, maybe...
Representative, my apologies. I am brushing up on my parliamentary procedure. We still have quorum from the previous committee, but I just want to ask the minority members, is it okay if we move this bill and adopt the amendment right now? Is it okay? Okay, so Representative Downey moves that House File 269 be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Downey also moves the A4 amendment. So if you want to address the A4 amendment, Representative Downey, and then we'll go to the bill. Wait, is that the amendment you want to move, I should say?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is.
Okay, so Ms. Downey moves the A4 amendment. To your amendment, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There were some good suggestions in the discussion in K-12 policy, and I think we've incorporated them to a large extent here in this bill. There was some confusion about the application of a percentage increase from the state to the settlements that were currently being bargained in the local school district. And so what we did was, as compared to trying to relate that to some kind of a percentage on an annual basis, staff worded language so that essentially the total dollar increase for the biennium from the state is the amount of the increase that the district has to offer the teachers in order to preclude the bargaining unit from embarking on a strike. So it's some fairly technical language that drives the increase to a dollar amount. And the thought there, members, was that if perhaps you have declining enrollment or increasing enrollment, a percentage may not be as accurate a reflection of the total budgetary impact as an actual dollar amount, inclusive of the enrollment factors. So that's where that comes in.
Okay. So, members, any discussion to the A4 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like?
Mr. Chair, there's actually one more component to the A4 amendment.
Sure. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It also expands the QEO to include all employee groups and not just teachers. That was a suggestion that was included. And it excludes fund balances, reserves, from the calculation of the settlement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any additional comments on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. Representative Downey, is the A3 amendment yours?
Mr. Chair, no. The A3 amendment may have been a preliminary version of the A4. I'm not sure where that came from. The only amendment I have is the A4.
All right. That's I am told by the whisper in my ear that's exactly what it is. The bill is now in the form you would like. To your bill, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So the concept, again, is pretty straightforward. It essentially says that if the local school district has offered a contract settlement to its bargaining units, either the teachers and or the other bargaining units that it's negotiating with, it has the ability, if it has extended an offer that equals the increase in funding from the state for that bargaining period, to invoke what's called a qualified economic offer contingency that says, having offered a qualified economic offer, the bargaining units cannot strike. So it is that straightforward, Mr. Chair, and I would stand for questions and future testimony.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Before we take questions, this is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify either for or against this bill? Whoever gets there first gets to talk first.
Do
Once you guys, you know, actually, I would prefer that you both sit up there at the same time. This would make a much more festive committee hearing. Fest. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bartholomew. Please say your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And, always happy to sit up here with Ms. Allswiger. I'd like to thank Representative Downey for introducing and carrying this bill. And before I start, I'd just like to be clear that we see this as a pro-teacher bill, despite some of the comments you may hear down the road. In fact, we're here asking for your support for House File 269 because it seems every year we hear announcements by school districts that they're going through another round of teacher layoffs and cuts in programs. And every time this happens, students are the ones that pay the price. One of the key reasons for these regular announcements of teacher layoffs is school boards have been unable to keep their contract settlements in line with available revenues. In short, districts are agreeing to spend more money than they have, and as a result, they have to cut teachers and programs to balance their budgets. We see House File 269, the qualified economic offer, as a critical option for school boards to keep their teachers and other employees. As Representative Downey mentioned, in essence, the QEO allows a school board to say, we're willing to increase compensation by the same amount of increase the district received from the state, but we don't want to spend more and then have to cut people. We're sure improvements to the bill can still be made, and the amendment that you adopted we think is very helpful. We're also open to a better strategy for at least limiting the number of teacher layoffs, but from our perspective, the current negotiation structure doesn't work, and students are suffering because of it. I'd like to anticipate some of the arguments you might hear against the QEO in House File 269 by offering the following. And I'm reminded by Representative Dreiling's comment earlier about listening with half an ear, having done once already. But the first argument, the QEO eliminates local control over contract negotiations. This is not true. No one is required to use a QEO. In fact, there may well be school boards that choose to totally ignore it. Nothing will change for them, and that's perfectly fine. Even for those boards that choose to use a QEO, we'd expect them to first negotiate in the same manner as they always have and would use the QEO as a last resort. Again, the QEO is a local option, not a mandate. The second argument, wouldn't increased funding for schools be a better solution for preventing teacher layoffs? And a lot of the focus on teacher layoffs has come from recent state and district deficits. Unfortunately, we've looked at district contract settlement and state funding increase data covering 27 years, going back to 1985. And in 18 of those 27 years, district contract settlements exceeded increases in the state formula. As another example, in 2004, the Minneapolis Star Tribune did an analysis of contract settlements and district funding. As part of that analysis, they found that from 1998 through 2003, 92 districts increased teacher pay over inflation while making staff cuts. It's fairly obvious that in good times or bad, when the state provides X in funding, school boards typically settle for X plus Y. The third argument, the QEO is a cap on salaries. Two responses. First, for those districts that choose to ignore the QEO, there is no impact. For boards that do choose to use it, again, it's presumed they're going to first go through their regular negotiation process. And there's nothing to say that if a board uses the QEO once, they'll use it again. I would say, under the QEO, that there would likely be a shift to benefits over salary because under the structure of the bill, benefits are paid for first, and then what's ever left over would go to salary. The second response, is if a school board is faced with a choice of agreeing to salary increases they can't afford or trying to provide smaller increases to preserve teacher jobs and programs, we'd argue that smaller increases in keeping teachers is best for students. This is especially true if we're trying to retain younger teachers at a time when half our current teachers are expected to retire over the next 10 years. We are not saying that anyone is doing anything wrong under the current system, and we certainly aren't saying that teachers are being paid too much. What we are saying is the current system doesn't work in the best interest of students or less senior teachers. We understand there are a lot of factors involved with these issues. And if there's a better way to give school boards the ability to balance contract costs with available revenues so they can keep more people, then we're certainly interested. But the data clearly indicates the current system is out of balance. And again, we'd like to thank Representative Downey for authoring the bill, and we'd ask for your support, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Halswager, to your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Halswager, Education, Minnesota. Well, I think this gets back to the issue of local control or state mandates, and certainly one could argue in some ways you are giving the local districts some local control, but that's, you know, I think that that can be debated. Because should a school board decide that they want to follow this partial mandate of authority, that you could just say, this is it, and that's all you're getting. I would like you to think about the past history of some of the bargaining units. So if a school, I talked earlier about personalities. Sometimes the issue is more about personalities than anything else. I guess maybe I should say the first thing, it's about funding than anything else, so I get that on record. But if a school board decides that they just want to say no, all they have to do is say we're going to implement the QEO. Done. Wage freeze. In fact, I would even say that it is more than a wage freeze. And I'm certainly interested in Representative Downey's take on this, and I know that there's an amendment that I just saw this evening, so he might want to correct me on a couple of these things if there is more information that I need to get from the amendment or the interpretation of this bill. But if you look at the first paragraph, subdivision 3A, we underline 1.12, total compensation. I would believe that would be total compensation, that would be the whole package related to the entire teaching force. Because total compensation, I think, would be that X dollar amount. So you'd have all staff, you'd have existing staff. Now, what happens then if indeed, well, I'll get back to the total compensation later as we go on, because I think that that is an important number to take into consideration. Also, in that first paragraph, it appears that a district could offer 0% the first year, because there's 0% in the general education revenue, and then does that mean that they could offer 5% in the second year? And I think that it's a little bit unclear. And then if you are doing that, then are you just really trying to take away the right to strike? Because an administration could say, we're going to give you 0% the first year and 10% the second year, but you still have, or 5% or whatever it is. I believe that's the way the bill reads. I'm certainly not trying to give you ideas on how to change this bill so that it is worse, but I think that's what your bill does, Representative Downey. Also, on line 1.14, you could strike for non-compensation issues. I believe that non-compensation issues probably would be defined as anything not on the salary schedule or benefits or maybe 403B contributions, something like that. But there are a number of policy items that are non-compensation issues but do have a cost. So how do you deal with that? Again, we're not trying to make this bill worse, but I think that there are some problems with this language. But the bottom line in the first paragraph is if a school board wants to offer a 0% increase, because I think we all know that there's going to be a 0% increase on the formula this year, we have just given our school employees or teachers a wage freeze. If you pair that with beginning on lines 2.10, and I go back to total compensation, and on line, going on to the next page, I believe it is, line 2.20, you have the total compensation counting as a contribution to the Teacher Retirement Association. Are you aware that a couple of years ago that Education Minnesota went along with an increase in the pension contribution with no benefit increase to be responsible fiscally so that our pension fund would be doing better? That means that our teachers probably would have to take a pay cut rather than just a wage freeze.
Ms. Halsmeyer, was that last year?
Pardon?
Was that the pension bill last year?
I believe it was 2 years ago that it takes effect this year. Or was it last year?
Okay. Was it eight?
Mr. Chair, I have so much fun, I just forget the time.
You guys supported last year's pension bill?
In the end, we were quietly supporting. At the beginning,
awfully Mr. quietly. Awfully quietly.
Mr. Chair, we were not happy with it, and if you would like me to go into my whole pensions spiel, I certainly can.
I just wanted to make sure I refreshed my recollection, because I remember it differently, but if things changed at the end, I just wanted to make sure there wasn't a different pension bill. I apologize for interrupting your testimony.
No, Mr. Chair, that is just fine. In the end, we decided that it was most important to have a fiscally sound pension fund, and that we were willing to pay 2% more towards our employee contribution without any benefit, even though our newer teachers have one of the worst systems compared to the other teachers in the state. But thank you for asking.
You're welcome.
Also, you know, included in this paragraph, and I think Mr. Bartholomew mentioned it, is that to some extent, is that the health insurance benefits take priority over actual salaries. Over the last 15 years, we have seen just dramatic increases in health insurance, and this means that the employees are going to be eating up all of those costs. Even in the wage freeze bill that Representative Downey offered, but then he was very smart to take out the school district employees, that did not have a wage freeze on insurance contributions. And this, I believe, you know, if there is money, then it would be. I think there's some interpretation there. So when you look at total compensation, I talked about that before, if you have, I think because of the term total compensation, you could end up cutting staff or cutting salaries because of the way the figures work. I want to also comment on a couple things that Mr. Bartholomew stated. He stated that for 18 out of 27 years, I believe, that there was an increase of a percentage more in teacher salaries when there was in revenue. I made the statement in your presence before, and that is that the Department of Education does an analysis of actual teacher salaries. Education Minnesota costs out negotiation proposals. MSBA costs out negotiation proposals. The costs that are reported out after a contract negotiation settlement are based on their projected costs. There have been a number of retirements. There have been layoffs. So that by the time you actually analyze the percentage that a school district is spending on the salary settlement, it is almost always less than what was projected, because we project going forward as if all employees stay in the field, as compared to the actual numbers that stay in for the next 2 years, because they're projecting that all of those employees will stay for 2 years, and we just know that that's not the case, and we know that there's layoffs. So to take numbers like that and make them very simple, I think, is a little dangerous. If you have, and the last statement is, attracting and retaining teachers is very important. You heard, I believe, the Bush Foundation said that a wage freeze actually would be problematic in trying to attract the best and the brightest teachers in the state. I would argue, if we are indeed interpreting this correct, looking at the TRA contribution increase, looking at what we're looking probably forward to or not so forward to in terms of no extra money on the general education formula, this bill actually, if a school board were to implement it, would be more problematic than the straight wage freeze bill. And I'm sorry, one last comment, Mr. Chair, is that if you look on lines 2.1 to 2.5, this is a classic example about state control, not local control, because if a school board decides that they want to do this, they are now told that if you are going to compensate on the in some way towards the salary, that first the salary increases must be based on alternative teacher pay or QComp. Secondly, then it's the number of years of service, so that would be steps. And third, it's the lanes. And I want you to think about this, the individuals who, I got a letter from a married couple. They decided that they weren't making any money in education. They decided the only way they could get more money in education was to both take out student loans, get their master's, so that they could bump a couple of lanes. So they did that. They are going to be graduating with their master's degree, both of them, this next school year. Their loans will come due. They will have to pay their loans. They will get. They could, if this school board decided to make a zero proposal, they would now make even less. So we think this is a bad idea, even though I know that Representative Downey has good intentions. We think that this is more like a state control. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, this is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of our committee hearing and go to member questions. Representative Downey, did you want to offer any comments first on the testimony we heard, or do you want to take members' questions first?
Mr. Chair, could I just respond? I was taking some notes as Ms. Alswager was making her comments, and there's a few things that I do think are important. We just need to get the premise of this bill straight, because I think the premise that Ms. Alswager was operating from is not even close to the intent nor the wording of the bill. And I think most of her assumptions maybe are based on past history, where the state has continually told every district exactly what to do and how to do it and when to do it and in what amount. And I think it's really important to know that this bill is permissive, number one. It is only invoked if the district can't come to an agreement and wants to be protected from having to offer an increase greater than what the state has offered that particular district. It doesn't mean that they can't settle for more. It doesn't mean they can't continue the contract negotiation process. It doesn't stipulate that they automatically go to a wage freeze. None of that is in here. It basically says teachers may not strike over compensation-related matters if the district has offered a dollar amount equal to the dollar amount that has been offered as an increase from the state to its funding. So there is nothing that requires, there's nothing that prescribes the exact settlement mechanisms, nothing in here at all regarding that. She also made mention that somehow the allocation would automatically go based on certain percentages to benefits and things. Again, it says, if a school board and teachers do not agree on the allocation, this bill doesn't shut down negotiations, it doesn't mandate hard freezes, it doesn't tell districts exactly what kind of a formula to use. It says, in the absence of an agreement, then there are certain mechanisms. But this does not shut down the bargaining process. It just gives the district an ability to be insulated from a strike if they have made a qualified economic offer. With regard to the total compensation and some of the other comments from Ms. Alschwager, we did offer the amendment to try and make clear the percentage mechanism was pretty difficult, and so we did do the amendment, which you maybe weren't here for, when we set it to be an increase. If the offer is increased at the amount, the dollar amount of the increase from the formula, then the QEO can be invoked. So it's not a percentage mechanism here. And yes, it is the total dollar increase, and yes, it does cover all of the compensation categories that are enumerated on page 2 as part of total compensation. I thought you did, Ms. Alschwager, did raise a good point and an interesting one about reporting the costs. So if this kind of cost calculation mechanism formula that's used to determine what the cost of the offer is from the district to the teachers is somewhat problematic, maybe we need to be a little more prescriptive in here or offer some suggestions as to what kind of cost calculation should be used by the district. That was a good point. But again, members, it was far over described as a mandate from the state level, when in fact this is an absolutely permissive bill and absolutely focused 100% on local control.
Thank you, Representative Downey. And Representative Greiling, before I call on you, we have to take care of just a minor tweak to the A-4 amendment. So I'm just going to move reconsideration of the A-4 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A-4 amendment is before us. Representative Downey, my understanding is on line 1.7, the or is supposed to be for. The word or is supposed to be for. And then on line 2.3, page 2, line 3, also the or is supposed to be for. Just a technical measure that's been given to me by House staff. Do you have any comments or questions about it?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The bill is once again back in the form that the author would like. Representative Ground.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I promised Representative Downey I would bring this question up again when we got to finance, and I wouldn't want to disappoint him. We have had a little bit of discussion of it already with Majority Leader Dean. But I asked, for those who aren't on policy, I just asked if we've had qualified economic offers and other bills like this in the past, and so I was wondering, other times these have been healthy discussions, and in the case of when the Wisconsin people were here with the QEO, I remember leaping from my chair and having all sorts of conniptions, and so I asked if this time, because the very day that we had the policy committee, it was February 24th, and I had just read in the Pioneer Press that day a quote from I thought it was a quote, but actually it's a paraphrasing of something that Representative Dean said that I'll read here. It's been a long time, even if people read this article. It's from Ruben Rosario's column. Quote, and Representative Matt Dean, the House Republicans' majority leader, has publicly stated that there would be no bill from his side of the aisle this session that would include collective bargaining restrictions. And so we had a discussion about the accuracy of quotes and so forth, and I asked if either at the time Chair Erickson or Representative Downey had discussed this with Representative Dean, and they hadn't, but in the subsequent discussion, Representative Dean sent me over on the House floor something that he said at that particular press conference that he was quoting himself from. But I've also talked to another legislator who heard him on the radio saying that similar thing. And so I wanted to then publicly re-ask this question of Representative Downey, that Representative Dean got a little testy with me that I would have been asking you what he said, and I'm not going to say that sort of thing anymore, but I would like to know if it's the intention of the House majority to actually we're not just discussing these bills, we really are going to have collective bargaining restrictions that are seriously considered, despite what Representative Dean said in the newspaper and on the radio.
Well, before I call on Representative Downey, I mean, it should just be a matter of the record that there was a collective bargaining restriction that was signed into law by Governor Dayton yesterday. So, as a matter of answering the question, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's passed the House, passed the Senate, it's been signed into law by the governor. But, Representative Downey, you can elaborate on that if you want, otherwise.
No, Mr. Chair, other than to maybe add that, yes, clearly we're hearing the bill in K-12 finance, and it passed Representative Erickson's committee as well. So I'd say, yes, we're serious about this provision.
Representative Greiling?
And that's, Mr. Chair, thank you. And that's been generally discussed. You know, there's individual legislators that are serious about things, and I've been serious about things that my caucus wasn't serious about. And so I'm just, that's what I'm asking. Obviously, I know Representative Downey is a serious legislator, and he's serious about his bill, but I want to know if your caucus has had any discussions on collective bargaining restrictions, and if that is a serious caucus position.
Well, no one in this room is authorized to speak for our caucus, Representative Greiling, but I think, again, as a matter of fact, I mean, the alternative licensure bill did have a provision in it regarding collective bargaining, which I think a group may interpret as being a restriction. I mean, that's in the bill, and that's a historical record. But in terms of what a caucus priority is, I don't think anyone in this room is authorized to identify what is a caucus priority or what is not.
Well, then,
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I will take it as this is a serious discussion, never mind what the majority leader said a couple weeks ago that I'm interpreting was actually accurately reported, and if this is a serious discussion, and I don't consider the alternative licensure bill as a big, huge collective bargaining restriction like this bill is, and like some of the other bills that we're looking at, and this seems to be collective bargaining day here at the Capitol. I will not rise out of my chair like I did a few years ago, but I will say that I strongly oppose this bill. I think that once again we are not looking at this big, huge budget deficit that we have. I think I heard the chair saying last night we're going to be cutting education, and I think to look always at the teachers and what they make and how it's bargained and how the school boards can't possibly deal with the current system is not the wrong place to be looking here. And so I object to the amount of time we're spending on this type of bill and compared to actually looking at the budget. And so I strongly oppose this bill, and that's all I'll say.
All right, and Representative Greiling, just to quote the alternative licensure bill, I mean, the language says a collective bargaining agreement may not. That is what the words of the bill say. So mm-hmm. I certainly don't interpret it as being the negative things that some people would characterize it as, but using your words and your definitions of what a restriction on a collective bargaining is, clearly it meets that standard. So that's what I'm going to reference. And my friend, you know, I did not say last night that I'm going to cut education. We didn't say that, and I didn't say that, and I won't say that. So I just had to make sure we correct that. But is there anything else, Representative Greiling,
well,
or are you good to go?
Well, you brought that up, Mr. Chair, and gave me another crack at it.
Oh,
if we don't, Mr. Chair and members and anyone else here, if we don't keep the agreement to have the $500 million stimulus money back in the next biennium, and then we call anything above that an increase or not a cut, we don't keep it that full amount, then I don't think being very truthful with the Minnesota citizens. So you may want to split hairs and have that sort of an interpretation, but maybe you're going to fight harder and do even better than I thought. But if it's going to be what you were kind of insinuating last night, then I would definitely call it a cut, and if you're going to be truthful.
Well, Representative Greiling, I insinuated nothing. I simply offered as a proposition of mathematics that the state's commitment, if it's above last year's commitment, if it's a higher number than last year's, is an increase. That's just a matter of mathematics, but we're going to have time to talk about this the next couple of days and weeks and months. But and maybe, Chair, and maybe if I stick around here long enough, Representative Greiling, maybe even years.
But Mr. Chair,
Representative Greiling,
thank you. That's the conversation I think we should be having. I think that's the conversation that this year is the serious conversation, and not just a healthy discussion. It's a essential discussion that we have for our students. We had Representative Dabney's amendment this morning asking, could the legislators get done by April 30th? And then he would be willing to consider some of those other things, and we all thought that was a silly notion. But I think that would be seriously a wonderful thing if we could, which means your time's a-wasting.
Representative Greiling, don't you love the fact that I cut you just as much slack as you cut me when I would sit there and ask those questions? Don't you love this?
Mr. Chair, I love it, and I'm
don't
so
think
glad
the
I was
does.
Good to you, so you have to be good to
I don't think the committee likes it, though.
That's their problem.
Representative Reinhart, and then Representative Bannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to preface my remarks by saying that I recognize that collective bargaining is not an easy process, and it can be very difficult and stressful for everyone involved, and we don't always succeed at our best goals and wishes in the process. However, that being said, I'll say that I think Mr. Bartholomew's remarks indicated that this bill is premised on the assumption that there is somewhat of an uneven playing field currently in collective bargaining that favors the teachers. I'm glad the bill is permissive. I see one of the results of the bill is enhancing the uneven playing field in the other direction, not evening it out. If I were advocating for a better way of improving collective bargaining, I would ask that we support all school board members and members of bargaining units in training in a collaborative process or interest-based bargaining. I think that's most in the interest of having a good outcome. What I see here is this bill, if it passed and became law, could be an excuse for very sloppy bargaining on the part of the school board because they have a backstop. They don't have to take the risks that you often need to take at the bargaining table. And I don't find that in the best interest of the quality environment that you want to exist in a community with a constructive professional relationship between a school board and the members of any bargaining unit. So I fault the bill because I think it makes it too easy not to do the hard work of collective bargaining.
Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To compare the alternative licensure bill with this bill in terms of what it does or doesn't do to collective bargaining is I don't think is a useful comparison. For the licensing bill requires interpretation in terms of what it does to that relationship between labor and management in the public sector, but this bill, this is an all-out assault on workers. This eliminates protections. This eliminates equality. This eliminates, at the end of the day, the rights of the worker and defers rights to the elected Board of Education and then the taxpayer. And I get that. Historically, when one looks at settlements and when you look at the number of strikes in school districts over the last 20 years, the data doesn't support, in my view, what this assault is all about. And at the end of the day, whether it's May 23rd or Thanksgiving or who knows when you cut education, and you will, when your cut to education is combined with the assault that's taking place here on workers, I really believe that at the end of the day, things that we talk about, the achievement gap and teacher evaluation and performance and all of those things that are really important policy discussions, I think those discussions will change remarkably when our product is evaluated by all of the stakeholders. And I have a strong suspicion that people are not going to be, the people will not be happy.
Representative,
but we'll see how that goes.
Representative Slocum.
Well, Mr. Chair, I read this and, oh my goodness, and I would like to just get in a room with you and argue at some point. But I think the strike, the idea about preventing strikes is smoke and mirrors. This is about honest collective bargaining and restricting it. And I'm in the classroom. I'm with your children all day long. I don't get to eat lunch. Oftentimes don't even get to go to the bathroom. Because I'm with your kids all day long. What's wrong in society is blamed on me. I am the teacher. I am at fault. I've done everything wrong. Everything. It doesn't matter how much schooling I've had. I can't bargain for a salary if this bill goes. This bill is wrong-headed, wrong-directioned, going the wrong way. I'm a card-carrying member of Education Minnesota. You betcha. And you know what? You all know, because you've worked with me, I tell them when they're wrong. And I vote that way. They don't own me because I'm a member. They're wrong sometimes. But this is wrong.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, Representative Slocum, I'm saddened to hear you say what you say, because I also carried a card for Education Minnesota, before that Minnesota Education, for a lot of years. And I know that we bargained for time to have to ourselves. That was part of our collective bargaining, and you know, I hope that you haven't lost that. But, Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask Representative Downey, you know, what I've learned over the years is that no longer is bargaining between teachers and school board members, it's between lawyers. And it's a lawyer on one side and a lawyer on the other side, and they are the ones who go back and forth and do the discussing. So to what extent will a qualified economic offer maybe bring us back to what really I believe in, and that's my bargaining unit, my leadership that I used to help elect, bargaining on my behalf with the representatives from the school board? To what extent can maybe this restore some of that tradition that I think made the system work?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, I think you actually are leading me into a comment that I wanted to make in response to Representative Slocum and Representative Anzelt's comments as well. And that's that I think this complex here at the state of statutory mandates on the process and the components and the numbers and the fact that so much seems to get worked out between the bureaucracy and the statewide teachers union down here at the state, and then kind of gets handed down to the local units of government and the local teachers groups, is part of what we're trying to break through, I would say kind of collectively across a number of these bills, to try and, it's kind of like when an adult tries to get in between two kids who just have to figure something out and oftentimes makes it worse. I feel like we have this entire complex of statutory requirements that actually do get in between teachers and school board members. And those teachers do teach those school board members' kids, and they're all part of one community, and their kids are playing together on the sports teams, and they go to the same churches and all of these things. And yet here we have created this extremely difficult maze to navigate, and we impose that from the state down. And so this is just one component among many that we've heard over the last couple of weeks that are all focused, I think, on local control, and in these tight budgetary times, focused on giving districts an ability for local cost control. And I want to bring us back to the chair's lingo for the committee: kids first, no excuses, no exceptions. And I think that's what we're trying to do. And you may disagree with me that this isn't the right means to getting to that end, but I hope we share that same end. And from my perspective, this is an important piece of that overall action that we're taking as a legislature to re-empower teachers and local districts to mind their business themselves and trusting that they're going to do a good job and that the outcomes will be equally as good as if we try to control all the strings from here at the state legislature. So I think I agree with what you're saying, if that was the answer you were looking for.
Representative Slocum, you wanted to follow up?
I did. I would just like to respond to Representative Erickson's comment. I haven't lost that time during the school day. It's in my contract. It's in words. And I choose because kids first, no excuses. They need one-on-one services. And I have classes with 36 and 37 students. So it makes it very hard to individualize. It's a different ball game.
Representative Slocum, I'd love to have you as a teacher for one of my kids. So, Representative Anzels.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somewhere along the line, probably in a union hall someplace, or probably on the job someplace, somebody said to me, "Work and sing. Eat on hay. You'll have pie in the sky when you die." That is what I think, Representative Downey, and you're a good person, but that's what I think you're trying to sell us. Pie in the sky. I call for a roll call or ask for a roll call.
We're laying this bill over, Representative.
Okay.
I guess we could roll call. I don't know what we could roll for Representative Anzels. I got nothing. Sorry. Is there anything else, Representative Anzels?
I think I'm through.
All right. Representative Downey, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to comment. I wanted to clear something up that Representative Erickson had said, and that is those folks that are negotiating. Now, I'm not, maybe in some districts there are some lawyers involved, but in the districts that I negotiated in, it was the hard-working educators with the hard-working management and school board members that live in the same community, that work in the same schools, that understand each other. And yes, they teach each other's kids, and they coach each other's kids, and they go to church with each other and shop in their stores and everything. But there were never lawyers involved in the negotiations process that I was involved in anyhow. And I want to make sure that, you know, that that's on record, that the negotiation processes, you know, that I had the opportunity to be participating in weren't the legal folk that, thank God, that were there mixing it up. It was the community people, the community folk and the school folk together. I want to just make that statement, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Is there any other comments from members of the committee? Representative Downey, any closing comments?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, Representative Downey renews his motion that House File 269 be laid as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Members, any other closing comments? Just a comment from the chair. I am continued to be impressed with the thoughtful dialogue and diversity of opinion of the members in this committee. And I'm just continuing to be impressed with it. And with that, this committee is adjourned.